The Shaq Show is a production of iHeartRadio. One of the things I hope to do with The Shaq Show is to react to news, to analyze something that goes on in the world. And while we don't have a whole lot of that happening in the world of golf right now, we did receive the exciting word that Marion Hollins, and this is exciting, by the way, for us historians and lovers of the game. A lot of you probably don't know who Marion Hollins is, but she's in the World Golf Hall of Fame. She will be inducted in the class that has already been announced to include Tiger Woods, likely to have some other pretty big names. And she is just an incredible figure. Obviously, I got acquainted with her place in the game of golf doing a book on Cypress Point, and also in researching everything about the Masters. And a lot of that research that I learned, and really the thing I believe that kind of put her over the top for the Hall of Fame, came from the work of David Owen, who wrote The Making of the Masters, which is a definitive account of the creation of the tournament and the club. It's an incredible book. It's incredible what he was able to share in that book. And I am very pleased to be joined by him now. And David, I guess the thing I want to know, first of all, is did you know anything about Marion Hollins when you began this project of researching the book?
No, I knew nothing about her. And it was while I was doing research on The Making of the Masters. I came across her name in some old correspondence and just started looking around. And everywhere I looked, there was something even more interesting. And she had this amazing, an amazing life. She was a terrific amateur player. She won the women's amateur when she was 28, I think. And she had come in, she'd been the runner up a few years before that. And then when she had, you know, all these crazy things, like she raced cars sometimes. She was the only woman in the United States with a men's polo handicap. And she had this, she loved golf. And in the 1920s, she founded a club on Long Island called Women's National Golf and Tennis Club. The men at a nearby country club on Long Island that apparently got tired of playing with their wives and they threw them out of the club. And so a group of those wives and other wealthy women led by Hollins created their own club. And they hired, it was nice.
Yeah.
It was, I think Stanford White designed the clubhouse or redesigned it. And, it was either Seth Rayner or Devereaux.
It was Devereaux Emmett. Yeah.
Devereaux Emmett designed the course.
Yep.
And it was with help from Hollins. And it was meant to be, a friendly course for women. Men were allowed to play there, but only as guests. And one of the many interesting things that she did, the head pro at Women's National was Ernest Jones, whom she had met in England. And Jones was his most famous book is Swing the Clubhead. He'd lost a leg in the First World War, and it made him rethink the golf swing, and decided that all the sort of body stuff wasn't important. What you had to do was you swing it. You have to swing the club. And he would demonstrate that by tying his pocket knife to a pocket handkerchief and swinging it back and forth. And he had a huge impact on golf instruction, and was cheap. You know, as far as Americans are concerned, Hollins had discovered him. She also discovered Alistair McKenzie, probably. She was hired by Samuel F. B. Morse, who had bought this huge piece of property on the Monterey Peninsula, and she was helped him develop it. And it's the piece of property that has what's now Pebble Beach Golf Club on it. And the property that she took charge of, Seth Rayner had been hired to design the course, and then he died. And so Hollins replaced him with Alistair McKenzie, and that's the Cypress Point Club. And she's McKenzie credited her with the most famous hole on that course. The par three 16th, where you have to hit your tee shot 200 yards over, from cliff to cliff over the water. Rayner thought that it was an impossible shot. Hollins disagreed. She teed up a ball and hit it successfully to the other side. And, you know, it's one of the great holes in golf.
Yeah.
McKenzie credited her with its design. And, Bobby Jones in 1929, he was expected to win the U.S. Amateur. He was winning everything at that point. And he was the medalist in the qualifier, but then he was beaten in the first round unexpectedly by the last qualifier, Johnny Goodman. And so he was in California with nothing to do. He played around at Cypress, which had opened the year before. He'd never seen it before, and he loved it. And then Hollins invited him to play with her in an exhibition match at Pasatiempo, another club that she had founded near Santa Cruz. And he did, and he loved it. And while they played, McKenzie, who had designed the course, walked along with them. And Jones and Clifford Roberts were just at that point talking about, they were beginning to think about building a golf club someplace in the South. And the obvious choice for the architect would have been Donald Ross, who expected to get that commission, I believe.
He was considered, you found that? I'm trying to remember
now. I think that's true.
Yeah,
I think that's true. Yeah. And he was, you know, it's just like he would be on anybody's list. And
right.
And I read, you never know what to think about these things, but that you read that he was disappointed later that he hadn't been. But at any rate, from that point forward, you know, McKenzie was not as well known then as he is now. He designed a couple of courses in England, and he was basically a newcomer until Jones, in a very short period of time, played these two courses. And they're, you know, Cypress is incomparable, and Pasatiempo was terrific. Pasatiempo also had a number of features that appealed to both Jones and Roberts initially. It had riding trails. It had tennis courts with clay imported from France. There was a beach club. There was, you know, and it was a real estate development, which
right.
was not something that happened there. Today, Hollins had hired Olmsted Brothers, the landscape architects, to create a development plan. And there were building lots all around the course, one of which McKenzie built a house on. So all of these ideas in the original plan for Augusta National, they were all there. Jones and Roberts hired McKenzie. They hired Olmsted Brothers to make the development plan. They were going to build two golf courses, one for men and one for women. It was going to be a huge new clubhouse. There were going to be riding trails and tennis courts, all these things that that were very close copies of what Hollins had done at Pasatiempo.
And there were going to be homes around the rim, right?
Oh, yeah, right. Yep. Right, yeah. Olmsted Brothers created, there was a map. You know, and this is the thing that people never believe. You could, for very little money, you could have bought, you know, not only could have joined the club for $350 and dues of $60 a year or whatever it was, but you could have bought a good sized building lot overlooking, you know, the tenth fairway all around the course. And there was only one buyer. It was a member who bought three lots beyond beyond the first green. And he built a huge house back there that was there until the 1970s when the club finally got it back and tore it down. And the last thing Clifford Roberts did before he took his own life was to be led by a waiter out onto the first tee so he could look up the first fairway and assure himself that the old Harrison house had been torn down, which by then it had. But you show people a picture of the first green. It's a big house right behind it. And Roberts in his book made it sound as though, well, we thought we might sell building lots around the course, but we changed our minds. But they tried really hard for 20 years to sell those lots. They were going to, nobody wanted to buy them. They considered leasing them. In the early after the war, they decided to try to make a kind of a middle class suburban residential development where the par three course is today. They cut rough roads. They had lots marked and everything like that. They showed it to local real estate agents. Nobody wanted it. There was one local real estate guy made them sort of a lowball offer. Robert sounded insulting. And then by then, in the early 1950s, so they've been trying for 20 years to sell building lots. But by then, in the 1950s, the Depression was over, the war was over, the economy was rebounding, and the club was in really for the first time in decent financial shape, and they didn't need to sell real estate. So they stopped.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break on the Shaq Show, and then we're going to get to the part where I think you helped put Marion Hollins over the top in terms of being in the World Golf Hall of Fame. All right, we're back. David, in your book, The Making of the Masters, the final piece, I think, to sort of the Marion story, and even though everything you've just laid out makes her worthy of being in the World Golf Hall of Fame already, in your research, you found that Dr. McKenzie sent her, in lieu of himself, at some point during the construction. Now, he was there quite a bit during the construction, but he was having trouble getting paid. Right. And I, as I read it in your book, part of the reason he sent Hollins was he didn't want to go. And part of it was because he trusted her and because she had already had such an influence on the building of Augusta National.
Yeah, it's true. McKenzie's original fee was, I think it was $10,000. They cut it to $5,000, but he never got even that. I mean,
right.
I don't know what they paid him. He couldn't afford to go, and he would write these begging letters practically to Roberts. You know, I'm reduced to playing golf with one club and a Woolworth ball, this kind of thing, that he and his wife were gathering firewood around their house to try to keep body and soul together. And he didn't have any money, and the club didn't have any money. I mean, you look at the old account books, they owed money to everybody. And still in 1934, when the first tournament was held, it was a really nice program with all these advertisements in it. And all the advertisers were people that the club owed money to, you know, the people who put in the irrigation system, you know, the people they bought dirt from, the people they bought sand from. It was just, it looks like this is a going enterprise. In fact, these were just all their debtors. So the club didn't have any money. They couldn't pay him. At one point, McKenzie wanted some, you know, some, I don't know, some kind of cheesy notes that he would then try to sell at a discount, loan. And Hollins helped him with that, and he got a little bit of money from that. But anyway, Hollins, at that point, she was rolling in it. She discovered oil. The money that she put into her fortune that she spent on Pasatiempo, she had money. So she came and looked. Roberts was upset, not because of her necessarily, but because he wanted McKenzie there.
Right.
And McKenzie never saw the course finished. He was never there again. But anyway, Hollins reported that she liked it a lot. She didn't contribute to the design, but she assured McKenzie that his ideas were being carried through.
So, David, the last thing I wanted to ask you about related to Marion and Augusta and Clifford Roberts was, I think the thing that we lose a little bit in thinking about this, or we easily forget, is that she was a woman doing this at a time, really telling a lot of men with pretty big egos how to do something, how to get it done, how to finish a project. And then I think what your research did was bring together what she did as a visionary, as a producer, and bringing all these great minds together. Is that something in your research of Augusta you sensed was difficult for Clifford Roberts? I don't think it was for Bobby Jones, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. They both, I think her main contribution to Augusta National, I mean, her real contribution to Augusta National was she created the template that they followed.
Yeah.
Pasatiempo was what they wanted when they started out. That was what they wanted. They used the people that she had used. So they didn't hesitate to, you know, to follow the example of a woman. When she actually came on site, it was a pretty, you know, nobody was there. Roberts wasn't there. Jones wasn't there. And she was just basically looking at it and assuring McKenzie that things were going according to plan. Roberts at that point, you know, he wanted McKenzie to be there taking part in it. So I'm not sure how he felt about, you know, taking advice or taking counsel from a woman. And I also don't know how much she actually she actually told them. I think mainly what she said was, it's good. It's, you know, it's, she gave her seal of approval.
Right.
But she was, you know, but it was there are two things that are interesting. Women's National did fine through the Great Depression.
Hmm.
And much better. They did much better than Augusta National did initially, but it's Augusta National that survived. Pasatiempo ended up, you know, it went into receivership, or it was, and Women's National, when the war came along, the women basically decided that they didn't want to keep it going. And, it was Augusta National that persisted with this kind of, I don't know, stubborn determination to survive these amazing setbacks. And part of it is that Holland's in the end of her career. She had this automobile accident. She died young. So this sort of powerful personality that she was it ceased to be there. And these projects of hers, this incredible, Pasatiempo was an incredibly ambitious project. You know, the war killed it. But I think that the what's interesting is that is partly that she does it. She's unique. You know, think of who is the name another woman who had this kind of visionary, successful golf course development record, and it may just be that. As with Women's National, when times got really tough, the women decided, you know, the women who were the members of it, who were running it, decided it wasn't worth it to keep going. And it wasn't this kind of, insane men's commitment to keeping a golf course alive.
Right.
Because she wasn't really herself, I think, at the end of her career, and she died. She was like 51 when she died.
Yeah.
We didn't get the full Marianne Hollins, but boy, when she was active, she was remarkable. In all these different fields, and she was a great athlete. And then she was, you know, Pasatiempo was the movie stars all hung out there. The idea of golf surrounded by a real estate development was not, that was new. She brought Ernest Jones to the United States, and she basically discovered Alistair McKenzie. Those are, any one of those is a major contribution to the history of golf, and they all came from her.
Yeah, there have been very few real superstar developers, we have Mike Kaiser today, but there haven't been many who really understood how to bring all these different people together and trust them and use their vision. So that impact on Augusta National is profound, and obviously in the places that she's left behind, because so few people even know that Cypress Point and Pasatiempo were real estate developments. They're so well done that you don't think about it in the way you think about it when you go somewhere else. You mentioned the war. In your book, The Making of the Masters, you covered quite a bit about Augusta National during the war years. They lost three Masters during that time, and we obviously are now in a holding pattern with the possibility of a November playing. Did anything about last week and not having a Masters and your time going through the archives and those war years strike you as interesting in these bizarre times?
Yeah, it was really weird, not having a Masters, because it, you know, if you're a golfer, it's so much of how you.
Oh yeah.
It's how you know it's spring,
and exactly,
and it's a part of it. And I found this thing that I hadn't necessarily been expecting. I didn't really enjoy watching replays of old tournaments.
Interesting,
It just made me feel kind of sad that the real thing wasn't on.
Yeah,
and so I watched a little bit, but not a whole lot. And it feels a little different now too, where, you know, in the war, it was a war. You had the things we stopped. Bobby Jones had this. What turned out to be a terrible idea, but the idea of we'll contribute to the war effort by grazing cattle on our golf course. And it turns out that cattle really like to eat azaleas, and they left these huge green, bright green spots all over the golf course where the cow pies landed, these intermittently fertilized fairways. So that was a disaster. But, you know, when they, you think about what it was like then from economic point of view, it's probably similar to what it is now. They had just scraped through the Great Depression. One thing people don't realize, this, the first Masters, when it was the Augusta National Invitation Tournament, it got a lot of headlines because Bobby Jones is going to return to competitive golf. After that, there wasn't a lot of easy ways to sell it. And the field was small to begin with, and it shrank steadily through the 30s. It was like, you know, it was smaller than my club's member guest by the late 1930s. It just started to turn around at the end of the 30s. And then the war came along, and it had to shut down completely. And there was no certainty when they did that they'd ever open up again or that the tournament would ever be held again. So I think that now, I mean, we're talking about November. We're not talking about 3 years from now.
So, right.
It doesn't seem quite the same. I've also found I'm getting a lot more done.
yeah.
Now that I'm not playing golf, I've played nine holes a few times, but, you know, and I'd really like to go back. One of the nice things about it is that there are no carts. My club is still open, sort of, but there are no carts. The golf shop is closed. No guests are allowed. So if you go, it's pretty nice. You know, it's just a handful of people out walking around, staying far away from each other. And it's really pretty pleasant. We would not be able to afford to. You mentioned Mike Kaiser a minute ago, and I think he's a pretty good analog, and it's the same kind of visionary. They had different ideas of what they were doing, but both of them had an impact on golf. Have had, you know, Kaiser definitely had an impact on golf, and Hollins did. Hollins is more invisible, but she was and her scope was smaller, but still, you know, she was a big deal.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that's what I think is wonderful about this Hall of Fame induction. And it took a long time, and it took all these little bits and pieces to be understood, and just this greater awareness of golf course design and design of all other elements of an experience that you enjoy when you go to these places. And it's just a more of an awakening of the impact that somebody can have besides being a great golfer. She just got people thinking a lot of different ways, and it's to me, it's a wonderful induction and announcement just on that notion alone, that there's more to the game than just people playing the game well, that there were people who were dreaming and envisioning other things. So you have written, I believe it's 11 books, I think.
No, it's more than that. It's probably.
It's a lot. Yeah.
Closer to 20. I've read a lot. Yeah.
Okay. And one of them, obviously you have some golf books. Besides The Making of the Masters, My Usual Game, and you did a book on Tiger Woods, and you did a compilation of essays that I love, Lure of the Links. But recently you've done a few things on water and a book on you called Green Metropolis, Why Living Smaller, Living Closer, Driving Less, or Keys to Sustainability. You touched on the changes to your golf experience and the few times you've played recently. Where do you, and I know this is a big question, but do you see major changes to the game coming out of this? What do you anticipate?
Nobody knows what the world is going to look like a year from now, 2 years from now. I think we were talking about this with a friend. So, and I think it will be different. I think that lots of things will be different. I've often thought, just in terms of, for environmental reasons, golf would still be fun if it were less over the top than it is
right
now. And you think about more the way it is in the British Isles, or has been in the British Isles, where, you know, they have advantages that we don't. The game arose there, so it arose to be played in the conditions that exist there. So they don't have to do the same kind of golf course maintenance that we do to create a surface on which you can play golf. But you can play golf and have a great time doing it on surfaces that don't look like carpet. And I think that maybe we will, for a variety of reasons, there'll be economic reasons, there'll be environmental reasons, there'll be health reasons why golf can be the way I like it better. Not everybody does, but
right,
there's a kind of scaled down, more more casual, more a little more rougher around the edges. I don't think that would be a bad thing. And one of the things that I've liked the best about, you know, one of my favorite Golf Digest assignments I had ever was I went to Scotland and rented a car and had my golf clubs, and I didn't play. I played only courses that I'd never heard of before. And
right. I remember that was a great piece.
It was really fun, and I would go someplace and I would play, and then I would say, okay, where should I go next? I go, oh, we're only 12 miles from, you know, Carnoustie. And I said, no, I don't want to play Carnoustie. Tell me someplace I've never heard of before. And they go, oh, okay. You know, you should go here. And the golf that way, where it's not, you're not paying $500 for your round, and you don't have all this sort of rigmarole around it,
yeah,
and vast clubhouses and all this kind of stuff. The little golf course that I belong to in my town, I think that the secret of its success is that we don't have a restaurant.
Mm.
It has a grill, you know, like a, you know, a barbecue grill out on a little patio, and it has a kitchen, but it's like a kitchen in your house, and there's no, it just makes it, it's just a golf club. And that's, to me, that's incredibly appealing. There are people who hate that, and they wish that it had, you know, all kinds of other activities along with it. But, you know, that's a scaled down role of golf would be, I would not have a problem with.
Yeah. Do you sense that the sport will be appreciated a bit more, either by the people who are in some form attached to it as a golfer, a lot of them not able to play now or restricted and missing it, but also as just a great form of recreation that you can distance and get exercise, right, and be outdoors. Do you see that possibility, or do you think some of the excesses that have tainted people's views of the sport will still be there, or maybe even made worse by this? I don't know.
Those views. Yeah. People don't. Human nature tends to be pretty durable. I've always made a joke, said, you know, my golf club, the average age has been rising. And I said, you know, one tough flu season and we would be in serious trouble. And you know, here we have that kind of thing. So I, you know, it'll be interesting to see how, what comes back. And it's not like even like 2008, where you kind of felt that there was a, where the unemployment rate was a fraction of what it is right now, and where you felt, okay, you know, this horrible thing, in a year or two, they won't be back to where they were, but they'll be on the mend, and people, things go on, and people forget that there was this, you know, they forgot about 1987. You kind of move on. This seems like it has at least the potential to change a lot of things permanently. My friends and I had seven friends and I, we were going to be going to Wales, when were we going? Like in a couple of weeks to play golf in Wales for 10 days. And that trip, we moved it to October. And when we did, this was in, I don't know, not too far into March. And one of the guys said, you really don't think we'll be going in May? And then like one day later, everybody was like, do you think October is far enough away? So, you know, every day it seemed, it still changes like that. And the, who knows what people will be thinking about traveling abroad to play golf, or if there'll even be any flights, or if people will think, you know, there's a risk that I go to the UK, what if I catch it there and I have to stay there I have to be treated there. Or if I'm suspected, I have to stay there in quarantine for 2 weeks. So I think there are all these question marks. And there's, you think of how much of the kind of golf infrastructure that we depend on, the tour groups, the tour companies, the golf course maintenance crews, or how many people will be willing to keep paying their dues through a crisis like this. Luckily, my club, you have to pay all your dues up front. And the deadline was like right before Connecticut shut down. So everybody was already in. But, there's so many committees I'm glad I'm not on. And one of them is I'm glad I'm not on the board of governors of the club. And I'm so many people who are having to make decisions based on not a whole lot of solid information.
Why Wales? May I just ask from a golf point of view? Not that I don't mean that as an indictment on Wales, because I've never played some of the courses there, and some of them look incredible. I'm just as a golfer, I'm curious how you guys pick that.
We've been everywhere else. And there are all these lithium pictures, you know, there are all these Lynx courses up up the coast.
Amazing.
And it's less expensive. And we thought, you know, they're not going to be as many people. One thing that it was not why we did it, but it turns out if you have to reschedule the trip, Wales is a lot easier than the old course. So, the people who are really sweating are the ones who put down a huge amount of money for packages at St. Andrews or at the fancy places, and who knows what's going to happen to them. You know, with us, I think that they'll be glad to see us whenever we show up, I kind of think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I will poke around the internet for that story. I remember it well, and I don't know if it's still online anywhere.
You'll find it out if you go to my website.
Perfect.
To myusualgame.com, and right. Maybe on the other one too. I think you'll find it there.
Okay, super. Well,
it was Backroad Scotland, I think was what it was called.
Backroad Scotland. Okay, great. Well, David, thank you so much for this impromptu conversation to discuss this lovely news about Marianne Hollins, and I hope you stay safe and get to play some golf soon under safe conditions there in Connecticut.
Yeah, same to you. Exactly. We'll play together sometime. We'll play over Zoom or something like that.
Thank you, David.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Hey, quick break here. Let's hear from our sponsors. I will put together some notes from this conversation with David. I hope you enjoy them at jeffshackelford.com. I already have a post up about Marianne with some links if you want to kind of go back in time and imagine what that was like and learn a little bit more about Augusta. I don't think it's ever the wrong time to be thinking about the Masters and the creation of that place. It's always fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. He is an incredible writer. If you don't recall his work, I will have some links up. That piece he wrote about lesser named, less famous golf courses was, I think, one of those, along with a couple others, some books like Michael Bamberger's book, To the Lynx Land, and Laura Rumensing's book on Dornick, that got people thinking you could play golf in Scotland and have a great time, even if it wasn't a very famous place. And I certainly endorse. There are so many fun links. I hope he gets to make that trip to Wales. As always, I want to thank the show's producer, Tim Porochka, for editing this together. And just a reminder, The Shack Show is a production of iHeartRadio. And as you know, for more podcasts from iHeart, visit the iHeartRadio app. It's a super app, gives you great notifications, or of course, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. We'll be back soon with another episode of The Shack Show.